The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on October 31 and written by Adele M. Banks and entitled 250 years later, Amazing Grace has filled churches, concerts, even commercials. James Walvin, a former Church of England choir boy and professor of history at the University of York, doesn't remember encountering Amazing Grace in song or in his hymnal. It wasn't until he traveled to the United States to research the history of slavery that he came upon the hymn introduced by John Newton, a former slave trader, in 1773. Since then, Walvin, the author of the new book, Amazing Grace, A Cultural History of the Beloved Hymn, has submerged himself in the hymn, which turns 250 this year and has become a staple of Sunday services that has been adapted and adopted by preachers, performers, and presidents. I wasn't too keen on Elvis's version, Walvin said, after a recent visit to the Library of Congress Amazing Grace collection, which includes more than 3,000 recordings of the song. The only one of Newton's hundreds of hymns that gained such international stature. I certainly was not keen on 1960s orchestra leader Mantovani's version, he added. I was amazed to listen to Janis Joplin's version. I mean, who'd think of Janis Joplin and Amazing Grace? Among the thousands of versions, Walvin is especially fond of bass baritone Paul Robeson's, that gives a nod to Queen of Soul Aretha Franklin, as well as a choir from Soweto, an extraordinarily haunting version of it, saying they all are effective in their own way, very distinctive ways. Walvin, 81, a longtime non-Christian who describes himself as steeped in Christian morality, spoke to the Religion News Service about the hymn, its composer, and the electrifying event when President Barack Obama drew on its power. This interview was edited for length and clarity. Why has Amazing Grace endured for 250 years? Amazing Grace survived, particularly in the United States and especially in African American communities, because its words speak to a human condition of suffering and people coming out of suffering. And its music has a kind of haunting refrain that soothes. It has a unique combination of important phraseology, words, verses, and the beguiling music. How do you explain the fact that John Newton, a former slave trader, wrote a hymn that's treasured by enslaved people and their descendants? I think young people find it very hard to get their heads around the fact that here is a hymn of great Christian significance written by a man who was stained by the brutality and violence of slavery. It's a historical paradox, really, but it extends beyond that hymn. There are millions of people at the time, on both sides of the Atlantic, ensnared in slavery, one way or another, who are deep Christians, God-fearing men and women who see no contradiction in their faith and their behavior toward Africans. And that's one of the extraordinary, difficult things to understand. You write that Newton spent years trying to become a Church of England priest before he was able to lead a parish and share his hymns. So this song might never have reached the international stage? Yes, it speaks to John Newton's perseverance. To become a minister, you had to have gone to one of the two main universities, Oxford or Cambridge, and he hadn't been close to either of them. He was not formally educated. Yet he was a deeply learned man and a deeply religious man. He had to fight against the institutions and against the church to let him in. Though most of the words are 250 years old, the tune we know best today is newer. How did that come about? The music that we associate with Amazing Grace today is not what most people sang for 60 years after Newton wrote it in December 1772. We know from the Lomax family, a father and son who recorded folk songs in the U.S. in the backwoods, that people sang the words through an extraordinary variety of songs. But it's the music that we now know came together with the words in the 1830s that actually creates that combination that is so potent and so durable. You trace the hymn's growing stature as the radio and recording industries grew. Is there an apex? Maybe President Obama singing it in 2015 in his eulogy for Mother Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church's Reverend Clementa Pinckney? I think what Obama did was to tap into the familiarity and popularity of the hymn in the United States. Obama knew if he sang it on that particularly very emotive moment that he would secure the backing of his largely African-American audience in Charleston. When he begins to sing, it looks as if it's spontaneous, and no one would claim that President Obama has a good singing voice. But it is an astonishing moment. And if you look at the way the clerics behind him rise to the occasion and the background musicians, they're scrambling to get their instruments lined up and working with the president. He knew the congregation would follow him, and he knew that by 2015, Amazing Grace had become effectively a second national anthem. Very few people don't know it, don't know of it, or don't recognize it. You note that advertisers have used Amazing Grace. Can you name some examples? People sell candies, they sell donuts, they sell funeral plans with Amazing Grace in the background. Sometimes people don't notice, but it's that subconscious music that somehow or other lulls people into a sense of appreciation for what's being promoted. Amazing Grace was part of the soundtrack of the Civil Rights Movement. What role did it play in the life of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in particular? At the end of those long, grueling days, when he's exhausted, threatened by all kinds of horrible violence, as he was trying to unwind and relax in the evening, Mahalia Jackson would sing Amazing Grace to him on the telephone. If that isn't an extraordinary insight into both those people, Jackson and King, I don't know what is. Here is one of America's great gospel singers and one of America's great leaders united in Amazing Grace. While there are many performances of Amazing Grace that you praise, you call the use of a few of its lines by January 6 insurrectionists a shameless hijacking of a much-loved American song. It is interesting that a small section of the crowd tried to use the hymn, but they ran out of steam. No one knew the words after the first verse. How have you celebrated the 250th anniversary? The anniversary was launched in Olney in Buckinghamshire, which is where it was written and first performed on New Year's Day in 1773. I was there. I talked about the hymn in this little village where this lovely church still exists, where Newton was the rector. I'm going to speak at the end of this year's celebrations. Earlier this month, I spoke at a care home in New York to only 12 people. Old people mostly, but not really very alert for all the obvious reasons, but they wanted to hear me talk about Amazing Grace. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on the 20th of October and written by Jenan Mahajir and Rebecca Russo, and is entitled Campuses Should Model Care, Engaging Deep Divides on Israel, Palestine, and Beyond. We are two senior leaders at a national interfaith organization, Interfaith America, who have deep personal connections to the tragic situation in Israel and Gaza, and profoundly differ in our analysis of the situation. Yet, it has also become clear where we do agree, on the importance of seeing each other and each other's people as fully human. We are bereft at the sheer loss of human life, of Israelis killed and remaining under threat from Hamas brutal attacks, and of continued Palestinian suffering as Israel invades Gaza. We recognize that we are able to write this piece together in a time of immense grief and tension because we have invested nearly a decade in building our friendship, one that uplifts our many shared values and honors the deep differences that still exist between us. I, Rebecca, am an American Jew who grew up visiting Israel regularly and spent nearly 2 years living there, including time volunteering with interfaith organizations and Palestinian communities in Jerusalem. I have dedicated my professional life to bridging religious and other divides, particularly on college and university campuses. In addition to my 7 years leading campus programs at Interfaith America, I spent years working at Hillel and understand both the richness of Jewish life on campus and the acute fear many Jewish students feel at times like this. Perhaps most importantly, I have a brother-in-law, sister-in-law, nieces, cousins, and countless extended family members and friends who live across Israel. My love for them and concern for their well-being, along with the well-being of all Jews worldwide, whom I consider my extended family, is the primary reason I have constantly been terrified these past few weeks. I, Jenin, am a Muslim American, and I have dedicated my professional life to the work of interfaith cooperation and building bridges in America. I came of age as a college student in September 2000 during the second Intifada, and as a leader in the Muslim student group, I organized my campus community to uplift the suffering of Palestinians under decades of occupation. In my 17 years of service at Interfaith America, I have trained hundreds of leaders with the skills of cultivating relationships, navigating deep differences, and collaborating on issues of common concern. I am also a mother of three beautiful children who are part Palestinian, part Irish, part Indian, and fully Muslim. Their Palestinian and Indian heritage is an important part of our family life, anchored in the ways we worship, celebrate, mourn, and love. Preserving the dignity of Palestinian life and narratives is deeply important and personal to me, as it is preserving the dignity of my children's family and their own stories. College campuses have become tinderboxes on the brink of eruption, exposing the intense pain that is very present within communities here in America. We both understand viscerally why the events of the past 2 weeks, which build on decades of conflict, violence, and competing narratives, have led many to turn inward, to focus on the safety of their own people. We understand this crisis feels and is existential for so many. And we also believe college campuses should be places where people can disagree deeply on Israel, Palestine, or any other issue while honoring each other's humanness. We hope that in this moment, both campus professionals and students will lead with care, creating space to honor the distinctive pain of both Israelis and Palestinians, and ensure that members of the campus community who are personally impacted by the current violence have the support they need. We hope campuses will ensure students' physical safety while highlighting our shared humanity and mourning with all those who are grieving. We hope students, staff, and faculty who disagree on this crisis will be able to learn and live together in community so institutions can continue to function, flourish, and do what they do best. And finally, while we understand this moment of crisis is not the time to begin the intensive work of building bridges across differences, we hope campuses will create space, for those who are ready and interested, for respectful conversations across these divides, to share personal stories and build empathy for others. Many resources exist for these conversations, including IA's Bridging the Gap resources, Greater Good Science Center's resources, and others. We have been heartened to hear that on some campuses where pre-existing structures and interfaith relationships were already in place, some of this bridge building has already begun to happen. Two faculty members at the University of California, Berkeley, Dr. Haitham Bazian in Middle Eastern Languages and Cultures, who was also an original founder of Students for Justice in Palestine, and Dr. Ron Hasner in Israel Studies, sent a powerful message together to students this week. They wrote, "We are two professors on this campus who disagree vehemently, but we have always treated one another with respect and dignity. Disagreement and differing points of view are an essential part of campus life, and we expect that you treat one another with the same respect and dignity that we are modeling here." A seemingly obvious yet painfully countercultural message. If you believe Palestinians have suffered under decades of occupation and must fight for justice, you can still express devastation and heartbreak for the killing of over 1,000 Jews. And if you believe Israel has suffered for decades under existential threat from terrorism and neighboring countries and must defend itself, you can still express devastation and heartbreak for the continued killing of Palestinians. This does not require belief in moral equivalence, only in compassion and honoring of human life. If the only way to make a case for our people, whoever they are, is to dehumanize another community of people so far that we no longer see them as people, then we risk losing our own humanity too. Professors Bazian and Hasner exemplify the best of what a campus can be, a place for scholarship that allows for diverging intellectual perspectives, and a place built on respect and relationships across those differences. We can disagree fundamentally about what is happening, why it is happening, and where responsibility lies for the current tragic violence, but we must see each other as human beings. We should mourn that thousands of innocent people are now dead, both in Gaza and in Israel. And we should come together to push back the rising tide of anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim bigotry here in the U.S. We are especially horrified by the brutal murder of Wadia Al-Fayoum, a Palestinian-American child in Illinois, our home state. Our small moment of hope is that we saw Muslim and Jewish communities coming together in the wake of this terrible hate crime to show care and solidarity despite differing political views. For us personally, we each feel strong solidarity with our own community in this moment, but we have not let that prevent us from acknowledging the pain of human beings outside of our community. Our deep love for our own families, friends, and people is not diminished by our recognition of the humanity of others. We pray that the coming days will bring increased calm and peace to Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. Yet, regardless of what may continue to unfold, we will maintain and deepen our friendship and show up for each other, even when we disagree in ways that are painful. We hope the U.S. campuses will be places to build these types of relationships and hold space respectively for diverging views, and that even when it feels hard and painful, we will prioritize seeing each other's humanity. Our last article was published by RNS on October 31 and entitled, "Why Black Women Like Yolanda Pierce Are Rising to Lead Top Theology Schools," by Rebecca Barber. At Mount Holyoke College, the oldest of the Seven Sisters Colleges, Danielle R. Holly was recently appointed as the school's 20th president. At Boston University, Melissa Gillum was recently appointed as its president. At Harvard, the oldest institution for higher learning, Claudine Gay was recently inaugurated as well. All three are the first black person to lead their institutions. Gillum is BU's first woman president. Fewer than 5% of PhDs in the U.S. are awarded to black women, according to a National Science Foundation survey, and institutions of higher learning face a dearth of representation of black women in leadership positions. But slowly, black women are stepping into positions of power, overcoming the racism and sexism that stymied many who came before them. Perhaps nobody has a better perspective on the movement than Yolanda Pierce, a specialist in womanist theology, a line of thought that came out of black church scholarship in the 1960s and 1970s that examines women's role in faith, scripture, and ministry. Dean of Howard University's School of Divinity since 2017, Pierce was appointed to succeed Towns as the Dean of the Divinity School at Vanderbilt earlier this year. "I'm excited, not just about me, but because there's so many things happening," Pierce said. Though she often says she was profoundly shaped by her grandparents, people of deep faith who raised her in the church, Pierce said she never dreamed as a young person of becoming a theologian. But at Princeton University, where she enrolled at age 16, she encountered Cornel West and his Introduction to African American Studies, and Albert Rabiteau, who taught her African American history. Both caused her to think more deeply about the study of religion. "Those two classes, it was like a movie. It just sparked my intellectual imagination because, for the first time, I understood that the study of religion, the study of African American culture, the study of black faith, they were all academic subjects," Pierce said in an interview with RNS. It wasn't until she got to Cornell University, where she would earn her doctorate, that Pierce encountered womanist theology. She recalls the first and second generations of womanist theologians such as Jacqueline Grant and Dolores Williams, who were naming something that directly spoke to her experiences. Like Pierce, Grant and Williams had grown up on theology about black people written by black men and theology about women written by white women. They took on the project of doing it for themselves. "I find that to be extraordinary because I think as scholars and researchers, that is what we're called to do. In the absence of a field, in the absence of a discipline, in the absence of something that reflects what is important to you, you step into that gap and create and produce the scholarship and research." Her discovery of womanist theology bent her scholarship toward not only women, but anyone who approaches scripture and faith from the margins. "I talk in my own work and write and speak a lot about class and growing up in poverty and the impact that has. Womanist theology was taking that very seriously," said Pierce. "Womanist theology took seriously the questions that women posed to text. They're also taking very seriously the questions that the marginalized, the least of these, the outcast in society, are posing to their sacred text and sacred traditions." The same concerns attracted her to Vanderbilt. For more than 100 years, the university's Divinity School has been known as the School of the Prophets. Notable alumni include Gardner C. Taylor, a prominent civil rights leader and mentor to Martin Luther King Jr., and James Lawson, who sued the Divinity School after he was expelled for organizing sit-ins to protest segregation. Lawson now has an institute at the school named in his honor. That commonality makes Pierce particularly well-equipped to lead the institution, said Carrie Day, a Vanderbilt PhD, who recently became the first black woman to be named a full professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, and who counts Pierce as a mentor. But Day sees the rise of peers and of black female divinity school deans in general as part of a wider movement in academia to acknowledge the racism and violence of their histories by raising up the voices of black women where they once blocked them. I think that Dean Pierce is coming to Vanderbilt at a critical time where institutions that are part of the theological education are being compelled to shift and change according to the new emerging trends that are arising, not only within religious communities, but within academia and the broader society, Day said. It allows for the possibility of beginning the hard work of deconstructing the forms of anti-blackness and whiteness, she added. Pierce is conscious that battling forces such as racism, sexism, and patriarchy takes an emotional and physical toll. Last month, two black women university presidents, Joanna A. Epps of Temple University, age 72, and Arithia T. Montague of Tennessee's four-campus Volunteer State Community College, age 56, died unexpectedly. While theology can seem an abstract pursuit, for Pierce and her counterparts, its concerns feel tangible and urgent. The only way to think about doing this work is that there are human beings on the other side of it, she said. There are life and death issues on the other side of it. I think womanist theology is very clear about that in terms of its practice, she added. But that is what gets me up every single day. Someone needs this work. Someone's life will be changed and transformed because of this work. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen next time, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.